This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Raleigh native Smedes York has witnessed decades of growth in his hometown, and he helped make some of it happen. His father developed Cameron Village in the late 1940s. He watched segregation dissolve at schools on Oberlin Road near his childhood home, and he tackled the redevelopment of the city during his time as mayor. Smedes York says the city's growth is connected in many ways to his own growth as a businessman, politician, and city planner. In fact, his memoir is called Growing Up with Raleigh, and Smedes York joins me now to talk about the past, present, and future of North Carolina's capital city. Smedes York, welcome to the State of Things. Good
to be here, Frank.
Also with us, John Sharp. He's a historian and the writer of Growing Up with Raleigh. Welcome, John.
Happy to be here.
Smedes, tell us about your family in Raleigh, North Carolina. How long has the family been here?
Well, it goes way back. Actually, my great-great-grandfather founded St. Mary's College in 1842. And my dad's family moved here in 1910, actually started the construction company, York Construction Company, in 1910. So it goes back a long way. And we cover that in the appendix.
Just that part of it. Well, you know, Cameron Village, obviously an icon, this kind of mixed development. We're very used to it now. But in the 1940s, when your dad proposed it, not the thing that people were ready for, right?
It was after the Second World War, and there was a lot going on in the community, but the idea of a shopping center of that scale and magnitude was very much visionary. And my dad had gotten the sort of inspiration from his active membership in the Urban Land Institute, Mr. J.C. Nichols in Kansas City. So he originally was going to build a lot more homes, but he decided to build this shopping center.
John Sharp is a historian. Tell us about that project itself, Cameron Village. Kind of what it is, and then where it fits in the history of urban development.
Well, it's a very important construction designed by a man named Seward Mott, who was a member of the Urban Land Institute, as Smedes says, and his plans was developed out of a program that he developed for the Community Planner, Community Builders Handbook. And the idea is to set a commercial project in the midst of a residential project so that the streets where the village actually is located, the commercial section, are on square blocks, six square blocks, surrounded by residential area that is built on a curvilinear pattern in order to give more privacy to the houses that are built along the street. And without having to have these intersections, these four-way intersections.
And what was the theory up until then in terms of commercial development, residential?
Basically, it was almost ad hoc. It's just what they needed to do. And so it was without much planning. But the planning began whenever they decided to interact with commercial and residential.
Basically, the retailing at that time, or prior to that time, was in your downtown areas, but also in areas like Five Points, which I would call shopping districts. They would not be under common ownership, under common management. So the idea of a shopping center, this was pre-mall. They were not malls. The idea of a shopping center was very visionary.
So you talk about that kind of development, which was progressive for its time, but then this was the South. We were talking about a segregated city like the rest of the South, and this is the city that you grew up in, and you were very much aware of that. Tell us about you, Smedes York, as a young man growing up in this city.
Well, certainly the reason that we did the book had a lot to do with the many cultural changes that have taken place in the city. One of the major ones, of course, is integration. And I grew up in a segregated society and saw a lot of that. In fact, referencing Cameron Village in the store Sears was there. We would go up there, and when I was like 10 playing hide and seek, and there'd be separate restrooms, colored men, colored women, white women, and even separate drinking fountains. So I saw a lot of that. And then I remember riding along Oberlin Road and looking at the Oberlin Road Elementary School, and that was when everybody was talking about separate but equal. And I remember remarking that just didn't look equal to me. Yeah. So it was a transition, and a lot of my sports activities played into that, where I would be on the court and everybody's equal on the court. And I spent one summer at Cutcher's Country Club in Monticello, New York, and not only played with African Americans, but went to the movies. And so that played a lot into my thinking and my background.
You played basketball for NC State.
I did play basketball for NC State. Everett Case was the coach, and I was a scholarship player, played a lot of freshman ball. We had mandatory freshman teams, redshirted a year, and then spent 2 years on the bench.
Well, then, as you say, you were playing with these integrated teams in the Catskills. Was that where you were?
The summer of 1960, I was went with some friends, actually John Speaks, another teammate. We played that summer and worked up at Kutcher's Country Club in Monticello, New York. But that was 1960. I mean, the Atlantic Coast Conference wasn't integrated in terms of basketball until the mid-1960s, so that was a full 5 or 6 years before that. But African-American players played in the Dixie Classic, for example. The great Oscar Robertson, one of the great players of all time, played in the 1958 Dixie Classic. So things were changing, no doubt about that.
John Smeeds talks about looking at African-American schools, saying these are not equal by any stretch. There was, of course, conversations about then having to integrate those schools. And Smeeds' father, Willie, was on the school board. Tell us about the cases that came before them.
The most important case was the one having to do with the integration of Murphy School. And Smeeds' father was on the school board at the time, and he is the one who made the motion for the integration of the schools, the Raleigh schools. So the contribution that Smeeds' father made was to move that project right along with the integration with the Murphy School.
And what year was this now?
That was 1960. In fact, when I was at Cutridge Country Club, that was also 1960. So it was like September of 1960, just a few months after that. I didn't really necessarily tie all that together, but that is a fact that it was 1960.
These are not easy decisions, and particularly at a time when Southerners were not ready for this. And so there were difficult conversations. There was the case of Joseph Holt, right?
Yes.
So tell us about that case.
Well, Joseph Holt, they had attempted to integrate the school. They attempted to integrate Broughton. And they tried a great deal of time. Their family spent a lot of time and energy trying to get the school integrated. But that failed. They thought that it was not a very good idea to integrate the high schools at the time. And that's why Smeeds' father suggested that the integration should take place in the lower grades, in the second grade, for example.
Start off earlier. So what kind of conversations are you having at home about all this, or are they coming home?
My dad, most of the conversations growing up was about business and about Cameron Village, and I remember that he had a plaque on the wall. I thought we were doing so well that it said, God bless our mortgaged home. But we talked some about that. But one thing that was kind of interesting, he was very involved with the ownership for a couple of years of the Raleigh baseball team, which was an independent team. And there we have in the book separate seating. So he was very much a pragmatist. He realized things needed to change. He wanted to change. I wouldn't say he was out there in front necessarily, but he was, again, pragmatic and worked closely with the African-American leaders in the city to effect this integration, which, as John said, took place in the second grade at Murphy School, and Bill Campbell was the first African-American student.
To what extent was he like-minded with other business leaders in Raleigh who saw that desegregation was inevitable and, in fact, desirable for business? I mean, this was something we heard, but I wonder on the ground, how common that
was. From my recollection and understanding and knowledge of how it happened, we had progressive leaders in Raleigh, both in the African-American and the white population, and I think we have generally had good race relations, and that's easy for me to say, but I think that has been the case. So we worked together. I know particularly Fred Carnage was on the school board, the Raleigh school board at that time. When integration took place, Raleigh school system was separate from the county school system. There were two school systems. So what was integrated was the Raleigh school system. But I know my dad and others worked closely with the African-American leaders, and everybody really wanted the same thing. They just wanted it to work well.
You worked with your dad in the business and also went into politics. When did you decide you wanted to get into politics?
I was in a Raleigh leadership in the early 70s, and Tom Bradshaw, who was mayor of Raleigh, and Waverly Atkins, and I wanted to get involved in the community, and I kept thinking, this is the way. I've got to be on the city council. I've never really wanted to do anything else other than that, and so I actually considered it in 71, considered it in 73, ended up running in 77, and served 2 years on the city council and then two year terms as mayor. But it, in my mind, it's always been more about the city than politics, although certainly politics is a big part of it. But never had any interest in doing anything beyond that because I've said several times, I think the highest political office is mayor of the city that you grew up in and that you love, and I don't really have any desire to do anything else politically.
Well, you make that distinction, but there are professional politicians who would argue that it's a false dichotomy, that in order to move things forward in a city, there has to be some process, and that process is politics. People get together, they log roll, they wheel and deal. Maybe they get into a back room somewhere, but one way or another, people got to make deals.
Politics is in business. Politics is in theater. Politics is in everything. My good friend Tony Jordan described politics is the art of the possible. And so I think that is what, certainly there is politics. Politics is about people, how they think, how they react, how you talk to them, how you can come to a consensus. So to my mind, that's where politics is. Actually, the city council of Raleigh is nonpartisan. So you don't run as a Democrat or Republican. And that's still the case today.
There's a lot of nice pictures in this book, including one of you in 1977 with Isabella Cannon. The photographer had to step back a little bit because the two of you are the very different height difference. But tell us about Isabella and your differences.
Yeah, that's a well-known picture in a lot of circles in that it was picked up by many newspapers all around the country. Some of them had a little caption, the long and short of it and things like that. But Isabella Cannon ran for mayor and was elected. She ran against Jack Coggins. And so she was on the city. That picture was taken when she'd been elected mayor in 77. I'd been elected to the city council. So we were both happy. That was at a breakfast at the Civic Center. But then 2 years later, not knowing she was going to run again, she hadn't declared, I sort of felt like that I would like to run for mayor. And so she ended up running. And so we had quite an election.
It was quite an election. John Sharp, if Smeeds is too is too close to it to tell us about it, there was a little friction there, huh?
There was friction, but when you consider that Smeeds is 6'4", and she's just under 5 feet, it makes a real contrast. The contrast was also evident in the style of campaigning. Smeeds' campaign was never to mention her name because he wanted to run on his record. And he wanted to talk about pulling the city together between the growth and the no growth people, when Mrs. Cannon apparently didn't adhere to that very well.
Well, tell us about that distinction, Smeeds, and this tension between growth and no growth.
It's still that tension, but I think in large part that makes for the great city we have, because you do have input from both sides, so to speak. But in the early 70s, there was a group that was really on the city council that was really trying to stop growth. And in my mind, you want to have good quality growth, but good growth comes from good economics, people having jobs. So there's a lot of positive aspects if it's done right. So along comes 77, and some of us have said, well, let's quit talking about the city council. Let's try to get on the city council. So that's what sort of led to it. But you're always going to have in a growing city a friction, and it's just a question of how it's handled. And I always give the example, which was county zoning, but Glenwood Avenue or Highway 70. It is developed strip development, but the sign ordinance, one sign per business, sidewalks for each side. So Raleigh seems to come together in a way that makes for, I think, a great city.
John Sharp began as a historian, although also the writer of Growing Up with Raleigh. Where does Raleigh fit in terms of how it has developed? It's one of the faster growing cities in the South. Others have grown fast as well. How does Raleigh compare?
Raleigh compares far and away better with its growth and its development and with the management of its growth. One of the opposition, those who were in opposition to growth in the city, said the best way to control the growth is not to pave the streets. So Raleigh's taken this, has not taken that to heart. They've decided that the best way to manage the growth is to see that the citizens are best served by the best services they can get.
Yeah, you get a lot of complaints that Raleigh is just an example of more urban sprawl.
Yeah.
Let me add a comment, though, Frank. The great change in Raleigh in the last 10 to 15 years is the resurgence of the central city, the downtown, people living closer in. So if you're going to grow, you're going to either have urban sprawl or you're going to have more in the urban core or you're going to have a combination. And for a while there was very little going on in the central part of the city. Now, so many apartment projects, so many restaurants, and I just feel really positive about what has happened.
Tell us about that, because you were part of the decision to close Fayetteville Street, and then it opened again. Tell us about the evolution.
Actually, I was not on the city council when it was a mall. That was actually in the early 70s. I came on in 77. But at the time, it was the right thing to do. It seemed like the right thing to do. Downtowns were struggling. Malls were coming in. Crabtree Valley Mall opened in 72. North Hills had been converted to a mall. So it seemed like a logical thing to do. But as time passed and people got used to more of the main street type approach, it was a logical thing to do. So having a grid street pattern downtown is great. But you go down now and you can go to how many different restaurants? 20, 30, 40, in the, depending on where you define the central core. Lots of people living. That is very good for the city. It's very good for the tax base. It sort of works against the urban sprawl that people feel like is an issue. So I think it's exciting.
If there's one complaint about or warning about the limitations on growth in this area, it is in public transportation and the lack of it. How do you feel about that? Is light rail any part of that?
I've been very supportive and working and I'm for of the light rail system. And I was on a committee a few years ago, and now it's been reopened. So I think it's going to happen. You know, the legislature has given us the authority for half-cent sales tax. The county commissioners would need to put that on a ballot. It's already passed in Orange and Durham County. So I don't think there's any question. Wake County today is 1 million. 25 years from now, it's probably going to be 2 million. So a lot of the rail will help, light rail will help set a land use pattern. So a lot of development, in addition to in the urban core, can be around the station. So very much a supporter of that.
Well, thank you both for being on the program. Smeeds York, former mayor of Raleigh, chair of York Properties, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Also with us, John Sharp, a historian who helped write the book, Growing Up with Raleigh. John, thank you.
My pleasure.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can go to our website, stateofthings.org, to see who was on the program and find out more about any of the dates that we have spoken of. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mwagdi, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley is our intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.